there are so many types of good wrestlers, and there are so many types of good boxers. It really depends on the individual person and how he or she is able to deploy their tactics in competition. So, for example, you have some boxers who are very good at staying, you know, kind of on the outside, working their reach, so throwing a lot of punches where they're able to strike their opponent but remain, like, slightly out of range. And then you have other boxers who are very good at fighting in the pocket, so getting in real close, fighting from a clinch, landing a lot of body strikes, and having good head movement. So what's fascinating about fighting sports in general is that when you put two opponents together, each brings their own style and their own skill set. And every fight, even if two competitors were to fight multiple times in a row, every time it would go down slightly differently.
That's interesting.
I mean, but that is the basic outline of how fighting sports really occur. Because it is a one-on-one arena, each time that competitors, you know, get together, that they address each other, you're going to have a slightly different outcome.
I'm thinking in terms of, so it takes a lot of different kinds of skills.
It does. I mean, boxers, kickboxers, wrestlers, they all train every component of their sport. And regardless of who their particular opponent is going to be in the future, if they know their particular opponent is going to be, they're still going to prepare for a variety of different types of tactics. And so a well-rounded fighter, obviously, especially at the upper echelons of the sports, they're going to have great footwork, they're going to have great head movement, they're going to have good control. But at the same time, they also are going to have their own styles. And again, that's why it's difficult to say sort of what the ideal fighter would look like, because there are so many different approaches. Often, as a coach myself, I'll watch professional fighters and I'll think, gosh, why are they doing that? What an odd move to make, or what a weird mistake, and then it ends up working out in that person's favor. So it's really hard to say that there's a precise approach, because there are so many variations that are based not only on style, but also on body type, on weight class, which, you know, all of these are weight class sports, and that has a difference. And also, you know, male competitors versus female competitors. So there's always going to be these slight different variations, and so everyone's going to have their own style.
So if women are competing, then there's more that they can bring than just strength. They can bring sort of, as I said before, a cunning and or a speed and balance and things like that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the great things about watching men and women fight at a variety of weight classes is that you see, you know, speed from the lightweights, and that can be female lightweights or male lightweights. And then with heavyweights, you tend to see more power, and that's true for men and women. And so really, it's interesting. I feel like there's less difference between the gender of the athlete and more about the weight class that really determines how their style is going to be displayed.
Okay. One of the things that you talk about in your book is that women have always been involved in boxing and in wrestling too, I guess, but that it wasn't really well known, or we seem to have forgotten over the years.
Correct. And I think a lot of that had to do with some of the discourse that was being put forth by various fighting commissions in the mid-20th century, when there was lawsuits that were being put forth against the New York Boxing Commission to allow women to receive their professional licenses in the 1970s. A lot of the arguments that the commission, which was all male, the arguments that they were making was that, you know, this has always been a male sport. This has always been a men's arena, and women are trying to infiltrate it. And so through those arguments, they really were trying to diminish all the previous history of women's fighting. Now, granted, it was not at the forefront. You had people like Jack Johnson and John Sullivan who were at the forefront of at least the histories. But if you look back at the newspapers themselves, a lot of times there were stories about female fighters that were headline news even before, you know, stories of male fighters. But somehow over the past 100 years or so, that history has really been, I think, ignored, and strategically so, because again, it is able to classify fighting sports as predominantly male when that is really not been the case throughout history.
You said that you did a lot of research for your book through newspapers and through looking at sources like that. Did you expect to find that there would be women when you first got started with it?
Right, that's a great question. You know, I knew that there had to be women, of course, and I had heard of a couple of, you know, stories, but when I was approached about writing this book, I began just to do sort of a cursory search and was really astonished at just how not just prevalent female fighters were, but also how celebrated they were. You know, one of the examples, the primary examples that we use, that I discuss in the book is Elizabeth Stokes, who was a fighter in the 1720s. And there were so many newspaper articles about her. And even when the first book on boxing was published in the early 19th century, the author praised her as being, you know, this, I think he called her an Amazon of, of English boxing history. So she was highly celebrated. And so I think what astonished me was not that women were competing, but that they were competing on such a large scale level, and that a number of the general public seemed to be very enthralled by their involvement, mm-hmm. And were not dismissive.
Yes, they were excited by it.
Absolutely.
Well, the other interesting thing that you brought out was that a lot of the early women were managed by their husbands.
Yeah, it's hard to determine from the newspaper articles whether they had been, the pair had been training together and then got married, or if they were married and then became training partners. It's difficult to say. I mean, I think from someone who is actually, I'm married, my husband and I met at the gym, and we corner each other when we compete, and we now own this gym together. And so there may be that idea of, familiarity breeds, romance in the gym, but it also could be the other way around, where it's, a couple is doing something and maybe the husband's been training for a long time and, is excited about it and shows his wife and she demonstrates potential, and then suddenly he's her fight coach. So, I would have loved to hear, to discover more details about that. But again, it would be fascinating. I would have loved to learn more about the romance behind the ring, probably because of my own romantic pugilistic beginnings with my husband.
Well, and you did find that there was boxing in other countries and more than in the United States early
Absolutely.
On.
Absolutely. I mean, history has demonstrated that essentially every culture across the world and across time has had some sort of martial art practice. And you can see this in small form, where you'll have history of these, kind of small farming communities in Germany that had a very specific wrestling style, to these tribes in the Philippines that have their different fighting styles. So I think every culture has had some sort of martial art.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about in the United States and some of the women boxers who've been known here. You have some interesting sort of vignettes about the women who are fighting and also pictures of them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was very, very fortunate to receive some photos that were actually from photographers shooting in the 1950s. What's interesting about the U.S. compared to Britain is that our country is actually a little bit less permissive of boxing as a whole than England was. And I explore this in the book, sort of trying to figure out exactly why this was. There's a lot of different arguments, but essentially boxing was seen especially as a, this kind of mother country sport. And so a lot of kind of the early United States social ventures were to try to differentiate our country from our past roots in England. And so boxing was not really seen as being not just a gentlemanly sport, but also just not a very American sport.
Oh.
Because of that, now boxing was still happening. It's just that it was not as popular, at least amongst the aristocracy in the U.S., as it was in England. Because of that, England has, obviously, it's an older country, it has a richer history, but the U.S. boxing really didn't get started as much until the 20th century, and there were sort of two zeitgeists for that. One is that boxing became popular in the late 1800s as a fitness venture for women, especially in New York, and especially for, rather funny, socialites. There's some really fantastic articles that I discuss in the book about these classes for, you know, apparently overweight housewives or also young women in their 20s trying to get them in better shape and using boxing as a vehicle for that, which makes perfect sense. We do that today. A lot of people box for fitness.
Mm-hmm.
That was sort of just as a popular venture, but there are stories of women coming out of those classes trying to actually compete, which is also really fun. But the way that boxing really became popular as a sport in the U.S. was really through this sort of carnival route in the early 20th century. So you would have these traveling fairs and circuses and carnivals, and boxing and wrestling both were often used as entertainments. And out of that tradition, we began to get more specific boxing shows that were a little bit more inclusive of different types of people. In the 1950s, there were three primary women in the U.S. who were competing against each other. There was Phyllis Kugler, Barbara Buttrick, and Joanne Hagen, and the three of them boxed each other several times, beat each other back and forth, and they were very popular. In fact, one of them was honored by a local organization for being the police woman of the year, which she wasn't a police woman. I think they just liked her appearance. But the three of them really made headlines, and certain states wouldn't allow them to box, and so they would travel and go to other states. And all three of them really remain this great example of the beginnings of women's boxing, professional boxing in the U.S., and the move towards becoming a legitimate sport for women.
Okay, good. You said that they were accepted, or they were able to fight in some states and not in others. And so there was kind of a struggle that women had to be allowed to fight. And some of them fought even though the police may break up the fight at any time, which must have been unnerving.
Absolutely. It was so astonishing to me when I was doing this research. I didn't realize that it was, you know, the late 70s, in fact, I believe 79, before a lot of women were able to receive licenses to box as professionals. And so, of course, this was done by a state-by-state basis because of the State Boxing Commission. But there were so many roadblocks in the way for women to compete in the sports that they loved. And many of them took the chance of being arrested or being fined in order to compete in these sports, and also to, you know, to prove their point that they should be able to be licensed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like their male counterparts, they should be able to get paid to do these competitions. Now, a lot of times in states, they would allow them to fight amateur or in exhibition matches. But if you're training and you're at the level to be a professional, you want to be able to get paid for your involvement.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really just incredible that it was that short a time ago. But there was a big struggle, and it wasn't just for boxing, it was for wrestling as well. In the 1956, there was a woman who was actually sued for competing in a wrestling tournament.
Oh.
And she fought back for her right to compete, and she was actually denied. So it was not just boxing where women were being restricted. It was really any fighting sports. And if we look at the history of Title IX, not as the end-all be-all of women's involvement in sports, but just the way that a lot of the language around Title IX addressed contact sports, those were really the primary areas where women were being restricted. It was seen as okay for women to compete in tennis, I guess what would be considered lighter sports, but anything that had contact, anything that really had too much of, I guess, sort of a masculine feel to it, women were really being restricted. And I mean, the fact that women's boxing wasn't even admitted into the Olympics until 2012, I think really says a lot about the way that our culture, and especially the institutions that are in place that govern sports, view female athletes.
Well, there was a time when any kind of vigorous activity was considered unhealthy for women.
Absolutely. When you look back on the 19th century and a lot of the medical journals and articles that were not just being published but also being promoted by doctors, they were concerned with women's, basically their uteruses falling out of their body from, you know, doing an activity that was too vigorous. And so there was a lot of misinformation, which probably just had a learning curve on the doctor's part. But I think a lot of that was also informed by biases and by a desire to keep women, you know, in the home and passive roles.
Mm-hmm. So you see being able to box or making it permissible, allowed to box and to wrestle as a feminist issue?
I see it definitely as a feminist issue and as a social issue. I think that restricting women from competing in anything is a problem socially. And a lot of, again, these restrictions were not based on medical facts or based on any sort of precise, you know, history. It was based on an ideology, the fact that these were men's activities, mm-hmm. that women just shouldn't be a part of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think the, you know, the feminist stance comes into play, because, you know, one of the goals of feminism is equal rights, and those kinds of restrictions demonstrate that even now in some arenas, you know, women are being denied the right to do the same things that men are allowed to do.
Which actually is making a living at some point, you know, for those that are successful.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Talk a little bit about Title IX, because you make an interesting point that Title IX really wasn't the basis of the fight for being allowed to compete.
Well, the reason why Title IX was not the primary driving factor is because Title IX specifically deals with schools and universities, and a lot of these women were looking for the ability to fight professionally, so it would have been outside the university and the school arena. But what Title IX, I think, really demonstrated was the fact that women were being systematically excluded from sports. And, you know, sports was just one aspect of Title IX. There were many other aspects to it, mm-hmm. but we think about sports because it was such an important factor. But we could see the passing of Title IX as being sort of a microcosm of a bigger movement towards allowing women to participate in activities outside of the schoolyard and into, you know, more professional careers as well. So I think the reason why Title IX is just one element is because we're also talking about this desire for women to compete professionally, which would really have nothing to do with the school system.
Mm-hmm. But there are laws that can be used to say that they should be able to.
Oh, absolutely. And the problem, again, especially with boxing and with wrestling, is that the individual states are governed by commissions. And at the time that a lot of the women who actually brought lawsuits in the 1970s, at the time that they were, you know, fighting for their right to be able to compete professionally, the commissions were primarily comprised of older men who did not like to, I don't want to, you know, put too much on them as an emotional thing, but maybe they didn't like to see this changing landscape for men and women's roles in the U.S. Maybe they were just very invested in history, but there was definitely a bias, a systematic bias against allowing women to compete. And so these commissions were able to basically use their own feelings about women and about what men and women's roles should be in the country in order to exclude women.
You also make an interesting point about economics. I think that what you were sort of heading towards is that men can think of sports as a way of making money and, you know, mm-hmm. becoming famous and rich and famous and things like that. And women haven't really done that very much.
That's a good point. I mean, not only were women trying to argue for their right to be able to compete professionally because they love their sports, but they were also looking for opportunities to support themselves economically from their activities. Most of the women who were competing in the 1970s were trying, the ones who were bringing forth these lawsuits were trying to do so in order to support themselves. And that was actually one of the arguments that they made in front of the courts, was that they were training very hard, but they were unable to support themselves because they were not allowed to get their licenses to compete. On another scale, the other problem with the way that sports were structured in the U.S., and to a certain extent today, this is ongoing, is that most athletes, they make money from being on a team or from purses, and that's how it works for boxing. They win a purse. They negotiate a sum. But a lot of athletes make the majority of their money from sponsorships. And there was not a lot of opportunities for women to get sponsorships if they weren't allowed to compete professionally, because most people aren't going to sponsor someone who is an exhibition fighter or an amateur fighter. I mean, that's sort of the definition of, you know, being an amateur fighter, is that you can't make any money off of your status. So women were excluded not only because they weren't able to get these purses or to negotiate for their payment for a fight, but also because they were unable to get sponsorship and endorsements.
And so what's the situation today?
Well, one of the issues today is that, first of all, women are definitely in a much better place today. I mean, this is undoubtedly true. The problem that most women, most female athletes, and this is true in fighting sports and other sports, the primary issue that a lot of women deal with when it comes to getting endorsements is that the most highly paid women, female athletes out there, tend to not only be very good at their sport, but they also tend to be conventionally attractive. And so the women who most closely adhere to whatever our gendered standards of beauty are at this point, those are the women who make the most money.
Oh, not the ones who are the best, necessarily.
Right, and, you know, that's not to say that the best female athletes out there are not also only, you know, they can be attractive as well. The number one female MMA fighter in the world, Ronda Rousey, she is the best. She's a fantastic fighter. She's a former Olympic judo medalist. She's also a very beautiful woman, and so she makes a lot of money, not only because she's a fantastic fighter, but also because, again, she's, you know, very easy on the eyes. At this point in a lot of fighting sports, another trend is that the lower in weight class that a woman is, the more money she makes. So women in the 135 bantamweight class, they tend to be more sponsored and have more opportunities than women who are in heavier weight classes.
Which is the
opposite.
Not only
is there more opportunities for sponsorship, but there's also just more recognition in general and more opportunities to compete.
And that's more or less the opposite of men.
That's so true. But that demonstrates, I think, right there that it's not just a female issue. It's an issue for men as well. I think the difference is that for women, especially when they're competing at a certain level, there is a pressure at a certain point for them to try to adhere to a standard of beauty, even if they don't necessarily want to put on makeup a certain way, or they don't want to straighten their hair, or they don't want to wear a certain type of clothing. They may get pressure from their agent, from the coach, from a particular media outlet to present themselves as close as they can be to this, you know, standard of beauty, just in order to get media coverage.
Yeah. You also make some interesting observations about racism or about race that come into boxing, I guess, in both men and women.
This is an issue that I think my background is that I have a PhD from the University of Denver, and I'm specialize in cultural studies and looking at things like critical race studies and feminism. And so, you know, one of the ways that people become marginalized is, you know, the further away that you get from the center of power. And in the U.S., the essential center of power is, you know, white, middle-class, straight male. The further, the more qualifiers that you add, the further you get away from that center of power. So you have black men, of course, have, not saying that they're completely disenfranchised or disempowered, but they're further from that hegemonic center. But, you know, African-American women are certainly more on the outside than their white counterparts, their white female counterparts. And there's definitely circumstances in the boxing world, the wrestling world, the MMA world, where white female athletes will get more attention and, again, thus more endorsements and sponsorship opportunities than African-American women or, you know, any other minority group. So an example of this that I discuss in the book is there were several women who brought forth lawsuits in the 1970s, you know, in order to get their professional boxing license. And the women who were really the forefront, they were black women, but the very first boxing license that was given out when they finally agreed to do so, they handed to the very conventionally pretty white woman mm-hmm. in front of the news cameras. And so it was a sort of a slap in the face to those women who had been there from the beginning fighting for their licenses. So there's certainly an element of racism that I think is prevalent, and it may not be intentional, but I think that it's again this awareness, this push towards putting the most conventionally attractive, sexiest blonde fighter at the forefront.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think that this history of women in boxing can do? What do you think that the awareness of what the history is will do?
Well, first, just the book was not just on boxing. It was on wrestling and all other fighting sports. And I think that's a really important distinction, because I think what the book reveals is that there's a very detailed history of women who have been attempting to compete in these various types of fighting sports, and that there is a legacy today that we, not as, you know, ignored on purpose, but that people should be aware of. I've heard that from many people who have read the book, who just said, gosh, I had no idea how much I owed to these women.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important to reveal the history, not just so we can appreciate the women who came before us, but also to show how history can really be ignored. And sometimes it's ignored for kind of a nefarious purpose. And so it's important to understand why somebody would want to forget a history of fighting sports for women, and what's at stake for us now. Is it, you know, in 20 years when women are competing, are they still going to be talking about this being a new thing? In that case, we are always going to be infiltrating a men's arena.
Mm-hmm.
We're never going to be an established part. We're always going to be the new kids. And that's a problem. We want to not just maintain our current status. We want to demonstrate the fact that women have always been a part of these sports, that we are a part of this legacy. We're not some new little blip on the martial arts map,
mm-hmm.
that we are part of not just maintaining the history of fighting sports in the U.S. and abroad, but also part in growing it for future generations.
What about the audiences? I think that in women's tennis, in the beginning, it was mostly women who were watching. But now women's tennis, I think, is watched probably more than men's tennis.
Mm-hmm.
What about audiences for women fighters?
So, you know, that's a really great question. So the majority of fighting fans are male. I mean, they really are. And that's from having gone to fight venues to watch, gone to bars to see where fights are being shown. So the majority of fans are male, but it's changing. There are a lot more female fans out there. And I think for a lot of women, it is very exciting not just to watch the men compete, but to watch women as well. Even if an audience member may never want to do the sport himself or herself,
mm-hmm.
it's exciting to see somebody who feels relatable. I don't mean relatable on an emotional level. I mean really like physically relatable, to think, wow, that could be me. I could have been doing something like that. It's really cool to watch a woman compete in something that is, again, has this false history of being entirely male. One thing that I have noticed over the years of watching, for the past 10 years, competitions is that the female fighters are being taken far more seriously than they were initially. You know, I talk about this in the book, that female fighters have always sort of like titillated audiences. But one of the things now, especially with the advent of the UFC's new women's divisions, and of course with women being introduced into the Olympics, is that there's a legitimizing aspect in the media that's really important, and it's helping, I think, expand audiences, and it's also helping to decrease just that sensational factor that used to be really one of the kind of unfortunate primary movers in the media mm-hmm. when it came to female fighters.
You mean the sexual angle?
Right, or, you know, the sexual angle, but also just the it's sort of this like sideshow variation of presenting female fighters, and it was ridiculous for several reasons. I mean, you know, one of the reasons it was so silly is because a lot of the time you would see better caliber fights from the female fighters, but the way that they were introduced by the announcers or the way that the fans would see it, or even the way it was promoted by the venue, would make it sort of this like sideshow aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was also a lot of cases in the early years of women being chosen to fight at a particular venue, and that they weren't skilled. They were being chosen because they were eye candy, essentially. And that actually happened a lot in the beginning. Luckily, it is becoming much less so at this point in time. Now, the women who are at the very top echelons of fighting are really and truly fantastic athletes, and they're proving themselves every day.
So this is a good time to be interested in women's fighting.
Yes, it's a fantastic time. It's a great time to see the sport grow. It's also a really interesting time, I think, because as certain fighters become popular again, like Ronda Rousey or like Holly Holmes or some of these other, you know, really popular boxers and MMA fighters, I think promoters are seeing the benefit of having more women fighters.
Mm-hmm.
The UFC, when it initially opened up a weight class for women, they just opened up the 135 weight class. In the past few months, they added a strawweight, 115-pound weight class, and they're looking to add more in the future. So it's a great time to see more women competing. It's also a great time, I think, for women and men who are interested to start training, because gyms are not these sort of bastions of machismo anymore.
Oh,
they've become really very diverse in the group of people who are training. The coaches are becoming more intelligent. It's not this, you know, stinky boys club, although those are fun too, but I mean, it's really becoming much more accepting. And I think one of the ways that you can tell that a sport has changed and that a sport is growing is not just what's happening at the very tip top, but what's happening at the level of the, you know, kind of everyday person who just wants to train. And right now, I think I could walk into any mixed martial arts gym in this country and find at least one other woman training. And that was not the case when I started 10 years ago.
Do you think the same is true of boxing?
I think boxing, yes. Well, boxing is an older sport. Boxing has a lot more history and it has a lot more investment. I think that boxing will always be a tough atmosphere to train in, but I don't think that's because it's some, you know, again, just like male stronghold, but rather because that's just the history of the sport itself.
Mm-hmm.
That it's a very brutal sport, and I think that the type of people who coach it tend to really sort of impart that feeling in their gym, and that's really, I think, fun as well. I love traditional boxing, but there are a lot of female boxers out there, and not just in the U.S. but abroad. There are so many great female boxers out there, and now that the Olympics have allowed women in again, I think that there's going to be a tremendous growth of women who are interested in training and competing, trying to one day get to that Olympic level.
Well, that opens up a lot of things for our listeners, a lot of things to be paying attention to. I'm talking to L.A. Jennings, and we're talking about her book, She's a Knockout. It's a history of women in fighting sports.
My website is www.lajennings.com. The book is also for sale from my publisher, Roman and Littlefield, on their website. And people are welcome to get in touch with me through my gym also, which is in Denver, called Train, Fight, Win, if they're interested in seeing what a fight gym looks like.
Oh, great. That's great. Again, this is L.A. Jennings. Well, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure speaking with you.